Once again, here we are sitting in this room. But it's still a unique occasion, isn't it? A unique moment. As we're here for the next little while, remembering that this is also a chance for our exploration of non-distraction. So here we are. Supportive environment again. Life happening, and we can have so many ideas about why life is happening at all. The scientists tell us one thing, well, they tell us lots of things actually. Mystics tell us other things, all these mysteries of metaphysics of creation. Stories of creation and why there is anything at all. But it's pretty mysterious, isn't it? Here we are. There is organic life in the middle of space, and we can know it. We know it's happening because there's awareness. Isn't that amazing? Isn't it amazing that there is anything at all? Why is there anything at all? Why isn't there just nothing? I can't even imagine what nothing would be like. But there's this. The entire history of the universe has conspired and resulted in this moment. So it may seem like just any other moment, any other occasion that we are in this hall together. But it's not just any moment, it's this unique occasion, which is somehow happening because of everything else that has ever happened anywhere. Isn't that immense? Something else had happened, this would be different. But that's what happened, and now this is what's here. Doesn't that kind of give a sense of respect to what's happening here? The awesomeness that it's like this, that it's happening at all. Not to mention the fact that we don't know when it will end, and we might not actually be here tomorrow. You know, we could go into a coma. We could die. People die every day. So that makes it even more immense just to simply appreciate that we are here and we can look. And recognize that fact. Just the tiniest little sound of bird in the distance, the tiniest tingling in your knee, the whisper of an idea. Butterfly in your belly, the tingling of your shirt on your back for half a second has got the entire universe in it. Because the entire universe is unfolding in this certain way, and the result is this instant. The t-shirt on your back is made by lots and lots of different people. From lots of different countries. Somebody planted the cotton. Somebody set up the cotton company. Somebody designed the shirt. Somebody made the dye. Somebody imported the shirt. The sun and the rain made the cotton grow. Your parents gave birth to you. Their parents gave birth to them. And because all those things happened in the way that they happened, you have a shirt on your back that's that particular shirt. And it makes that particular tingling sensation right now. Doesn't that make the tiniest little tingle into something very worth investigating? You don't want to miss it, do you, when you know what's happened to make it happen? If there's any speck of merit from this reflection, I would like to dedicate it today to the Dalai Lama, because it's his birthday. He's 77 today. These are some of his words. Remember that the best relationship is one in which your love for each other exceeds your need for each other. Remember that the best relationship is one in which your love for each other exceeds your need for each other. Your love for each other exceeds your need for each other. Now, to me, that says something like, love is about going beyond yourself. And this week we've been using the word love, been using the word metta, loving kindness and compassion. And I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about love as a expression of us going beyond ourselves somehow. Because it's not just love for love's sake. Remember when we read the Metta Sutta? The last few lines of the Metta Sutta are this. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Is not born again into this world. It's kind of an interesting sentence, isn't it? What would that mean, born again into this world? Well, for me, what that tells us is that the Buddha was teaching this metta because it's liberating. The soteriology, the liberation theory of Buddhism, is that we keep getting reborn, and that is suffering, or has suffering in it. And that rebirth, without talking about reincarnation and everything, can end in liberation. So the fact that at the end of the Metta Sutta is saying the one who does this is not born again into this world means that this practice liberates you. Sometimes metta is described as love that connects. When we are willing to go and greet somebody and acknowledge them and meet them and connect. When we're willing to move close to an object in our experience, like an emotion or sensation in the body or a thought or a sound. When we're willing to bring attention to it, that is connecting, that is metta. To attend is to love. It is said sometimes that metta can become too sentimental, too fluffy, too sweet, too positive. Oh, isn't everything always nice, 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 too nice? Isn't that kind of annoying? I'm not feeling nice. I don't want fluffy. That cat's too fluffy. And when we start to connect, when metta is activated, then we can't actually avoid a certain part of life, which is pain. And then our metta transforms or morphs or metamorphosizes into compassion. The Pali word and the Sanskrit word for that is karuna. So we've talked about this a little this week. This is also described as love that responds. It senses that there's suffering, there's pain, there's dukkha, and it wants to do something about it. And it has a different quality, has a different feel. And this counterbalances metta being too fluffy. Because life isn't just fluffy. Of course it has got lots of fluffiness in it, but it's also got gritty stuff that we don't want to feel. So if we're true to our metta, to our connection, when it connects with pain, transforms into karuna, or compassion. This is another mode of love, another mode in which we go beyond ourself. I'm trying to think of a specific example. When a mum in the middle of the night has to get up to hold her crying baby, she would rather just sleep. She has to kind of find the courage to go beyond her need to sleep, for her love to be greater for her child. The best relationship is the one in which your love for each other exceeds your need for each other. But life isn't all just gritty doom and gloom, is it? Sometimes there is joy that happens. So the third kind of love is love that celebrates. Love that sees somebody doing really well in themselves and can celebrate that. Love that can appreciate our own goodness. What happens when something goes really well for us in the retreat? We feel like it's all lined up. It starts to go well and we feel like, oh wow, this is really good. This works. I like this. This is significant. I've never felt that before. I didn't know I existed in that part of awareness. I didn't know the mind could do that. We're allowed to celebrate that. We're allowed to go, that's good. The thing is, sometimes we're scared of celebrating it because we might seem arrogant or proud. But to really acknowledge, I've done something good today. I've come back to this hall. Each of you has come back to this hall again and again with the intention to listen somehow. And that's really good. That's really hard. And you're allowed to appreciate that in yourself and each other. I'm allowed to sit here and celebrate you guys doing something good rather than feeling maybe envious or jealous or, yeah, but I need to be better than you. It's good, you can do well, but don't get too big. Don't get too happy. Don't get enlightened. So that's love when it celebrates, when it sees joy in the world. The Pali word for that is mudita, sometimes called empathetic joy, which means we can share in the joy and the success that's all around us, even if it doesn't feel like it's ours at the moment. The fourth kind of love is sometimes described as the love that allows. It's not the fourth kind of love really, it's the fourth mode maybe. The fourth expression, the fourth dance, the fourth way love can be. Equanimity, the love that allows. What is there in your heart as you sit here this moment which can allow the entire universe to be and to move as it is? That can stay centered. Even though this thing pulls you over here, that thing pulls you over there, this thing pushes you this way, that thing pushes you that way, you want this, you don't want that, you should be like this, you shouldn't be like that, it's not good enough as it is. There's some capacity that we have which can remain equal-minded, steady in the ups and downs. I'm wondering how to connect it to another expression of this, which is that each one of us is equally worthy of love. I think there's quite a high bar that you find in the teachings about going beyond ourselves and our needs, our preferences maybe, where we're asked to care for people we don't know as deeply as people that we're related to. We're asked to care as much about ourselves as somebody we've never met. What is it? What is the human heart that can be as committed to the welfare of somebody in a public toilet in Los Angeles right now that you've never met and you? Is it possible to care deeply about your well-being and their well-being without saying that one is more valuable than the other? What would that be like? Yeah, equanimity, sometimes described as the love of a grandparent. So I don't know if anybody here this week has felt like their mind is a crying, crazy grandchild, little person who just wants this, doesn't want to be in the hall, wants to go and have fun, wants to go and have a swim, wants to go and have a cup of tea, wants to read a book, wants to go and play. Wants to go and play, doesn't want to do this, this is boring, I want to do something fun, this is boring, why am I here again? What would a grandparent do if a grandchild was doing that? They probably wouldn't get really kind of anxious and worried and controlling, would they? They might do. But the point here is that they would just let the child complain and run about and do stuff. They stop it falling in the river and turning on the oven and getting in the oven. But apart from that, you can just let it do its thing. A parent, on the other hand, would be more attached to the child being a certain way, perhaps. So if it's a helpful metaphor, then babysit your grandchild mind when you're in this hall. Knowing that, oh, it's got its whole life ahead. And it's going to do all sorts of crazy stuff. But I still love it, and I'll still stop it hurting itself really badly if I can. It's kind of spacious, isn't it? Another interesting dimension of equanimity, this love that allows, love when it is allowing, is that it understands that we can't just take each other's suffering from them. That in some really significant way, the dukkha, the troubles that we have inherited, that we're born with, that are part of being a person, are a really important thing that we have. They're a kind of annoying gift. And equanimity knows that I can't just take Sampo's grief from him like that. I can be here, be supportive in certain ways. But it's his mind that has to experience its own healing. So when we have equanimity, we're not so caught up, we're not so invested in other people actually having success and healing, because it's their path. So it's kind of the space about it. We're not all interfering and saying, I'll see what I can do, I'll see what I can do, don't worry, cheer up, I'll see what I can do, or something. That's perhaps a silly example. It lets each other be with what we have to learn. The danger with equanimity is it can get a bit cold and detached. It can be so uninvested that it becomes cold, becomes uncaring, indifferent. Which is where we come back to metta. So metta looks after this piece. It says, ah, cold and indifferent, okay. Well, there is this heart fire of metta as well. So in this kind of magical and intelligent way, these four aspects of love work together. Different shapes love can take. Love that connects, love that responds, love that celebrates, and love that allows. Loving kindness, compassion, celebration, and equanimity. Equanimity doesn't just turn up in these four qualities. You also get equanimity spoken about in another list of qualities in the teachings. And Caroline and I did a retreat on it, I think it was this time last year actually. The seven factors of awakening. I'm going to have to remember them now, aren't I? It's three energizing ones. Three calming ones and mindfulness. So, interest, energy, joy, mindfulness, tranquility, one-pointedness, and equanimity. Okay, so the important thing here is that the equanimity is the kind of, can be seen as the culmination of them. So we do our practice here, and what grows is this equanimity. What mind can allow absolutely anything to pass through it without problem? What heart is so vast and open and non-clinging that whatever reactivity, whatever event occurs, doesn't get tangled up and stuck and cause the confused, jarring, non-flowing dukkha? Caroline yesterday was talking about how, actually I can't remember if it was in the hall or in a conversation, but it was about dukkha jamming up the flow of life. Was that in the talk yesterday? Yeah. Okay. So what heart can allow life to be and to flow without jamming it up? The dukkha that makes it all awkward and frustrating, it doesn't seem to work and you can't ever quite get where I want to get. It's always something that's not quite right. Well, one, the mind of equanimity. This quality is equanimity. And it's an important kind of place to be, a deep equanimous place, because the teachings say that in this place the mind can open to nibbana. There can be moments of realization where you're changed. Something is seen so clearly that you know from that point on, whenever there is dukkha, it has a resolution. No problem is forever. No problem is insoluble. No problem is actually solid. In a way, there's no such thing as a problem. One of my teachers, Christopher Titmus, sometimes would ask, when he was kind of trying to help us, pointing to this great heart of equanimity, what is this extraordinary element which is so accommodating? So here we are, now, in this room again. I've got a memory of having just been speaking to you. No idea if it's real. What is this extraordinary element that is so accommodating? Accommodating, allowing. The open space of the mind. A heart released from clinging. Nothing getting stuck, things being known. One metaphor you get in the Tibetan traditions is like paint being thrown up into the air. So imagine chucking a bucket of rainbow coloured paint up into the air. It's there for a while, it changes, it goes up into the air, there's this display, there's colour, there's shape. It's moving, it's in flux, and then it falls back and it's gone. And the sky stays the same. So if our experience is like this paint, flung up into the air, what is the space of mind that isn't stained by that? So as we're sitting here now, our brains are busy thinking away, grinding out thoughts, painting pictures, imagining this, imagining that. This display happening in our, somewhere in us. Where does the thought happen? Wherever they happen. And what isn't stained by them? What allows them to move and yet isn't stained by them? Mind that knows that there is experience is knowing, but it's also open because it's allowing, it's open and it's knowing, it's open because it's not clinging. In the moment of love, the empty essence dawns nakedly. Something to do with when the heart is open, when love is functioning, when it's connecting, responding, celebrating, allowing. We're in a good place to look and see what is the mind itself. What is it that knows experience? And in some traditions you get talk of the empty essence. Empty and yet cognizant. So we have this word empty. Cognizant means knowing. So if love is going beyond the self, and going beyond the self is liberating, we're going to have to look and see what this self is. Me. What am I? What is this being here? If I get rid of my arms, I reckon I'm still here. Legs, hair, I'm still here. Erase my memories, am I still here? What is it that goes into making up an individual? What makes you? Well, this takes us back to where we started the talk, doesn't it? You are as you are right now because of everything else in the universe contributing to you being as you are. I wonder if that makes any sense. I have my opinions because I've inherited them, largely, I believe. I have my genes because I've inherited them. I have my physical body because of food, which has come from outside of me. So every element of me, every element of you, can be said to be a non-you. So where are you? It's non-you because it came from outside you. The language that we think our most private personal thoughts with is a public language that we've inherited from everyone else, from our ancestors, from our community around us. So the point of all this is that in the Dharma teachings, clinging to self, Caroline yesterday talking about moha, ignorance, misseeing, and avidya, which is that seeing?
Not seeing.
Not seeing. They mean the same thing. Not seeing. Clinging to the self is not seeing that the self includes the rest of the universe. So when we think we're isolated and separate, that is avidya, not seeing that even though we are utterly unique, we also contain everything else. This is from Kalu Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan teacher. This is from his last incarnation anyway, so we won't go there right now. You live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. You are that reality. When you understand this, you will see that you are nothing. And being nothing, you are everything. That is all. You will see that you are nothing. And being nothing, you are everything. That is all. Nisargadatta Maharaj, an old Indian saint who died in the last 50 years or so, I think. Not exactly sure. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. Between these two, my life flows. Trungpa Rinpoche. Compassion is the atmosphere in which wisdom dawns. Wisdom is the understanding of emptiness, of interdependence, of this fact that we are made up of everything else. And it's that understanding that liberates us from clinging. So what we're doing here this week is not a small thing when you put it in this context, is it? You know, we are quite potentially going down a very, very interesting rabbit hole. So how far down the rabbit hole are you going to go? So just finishing with a little reflection on our situation here. Do you think there's just one room here that we're in? Have we been coming into this room? There's one room here. Is that kind of a fairly sensible statement? Yeah, there's one room, we go there and we've been sitting in it every day. Just one room. More accurate to say there's about 40. In fact, infinite rooms. Infinite situations. It's actually empty of being one particular thing. Because sometimes it's a gym. Sometimes it's a kitchen. Sometimes it's a science laboratory. Sometimes it's a temple. Sometimes it's a refugee camp. Sometimes it's a school. Sometimes it is an expedition house. What else is it? Any ideas? What else has this been for you at different times this week? This empty room. You're allowed to say something if you want, but I bet you won't. An asylum. Thank you.
A lounge.
A lounge.
A sauna.
A
mosquito house.
A mosquito house. Theatre. Which one is it? It's all of them, isn't it? It's not. It's nothing but what we make it. With our metta, the difficult person becomes a lovable person. Oh, I thought they were difficult. So think. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen next, or what to say next.